FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. It's June 2nd, 2017. First 5 months of the year behind us. And latest job numbers, well, to summarize it, more bartenders, less engineers. And John Rubino is with us now. By the way, email us, kl@kerrylutz.com. John, good morning.
Morning, Kerry. Yeah, good timing today, too. We had a brutal jobs market report that was just released. And basically, it shows way fewer jobs being created than expected. Big revisions to past month's reports, which wiped out a lot of jobs. And the internals are even worse than the headline numbers, because we lost 367,000 full-time jobs in the last month and gained 133,000 part-time jobs. So not only are we not creating as many jobs as we expected to, but the jobs we are creating are mostly part-time jobs. And 608,000 people left the labor force, which reversed a trend of people coming back into the labor force in previous months. So this looks like the kind of thing that we saw, you know, 2 years ago, when the unemployment rate goes down, but everything else is terrible about the report. Yeah. The market's kind of reacted to it. Interest rates went down in the U.S. pretty dramatically. You know, treasury bond yields now are at pretty close to their low level for the past 12 months, which implies a slowing economy and money flowing back into fixed income. Stocks didn't necessarily react too much to it. The Dow and the S&P, let me see, as we speak, are up slightly, you know. So low interest rates are also kind of sort of good for stocks, although with kind of a mixed message. You know, if low interest rates imply a weak economy, that's bad for stocks. But if they imply a better trade-off or a better comparison between dividend yields on equities and bond yields, then that's good for stocks. So stocks basically went up again.
Everything is good for stocks. You know that. No matter what happens, we're living in the best of all possible worlds. Condi and Zada.
Yeah, well, you know, what everybody expects, I think, is the Fed to come in at some point and start buying equities explicitly instead of doing it secretly through the plunge protection team. Mm-hmm. It's just going to be explicit government policy to support the stock market by creating money out of thin air and buying equities. Now, that, you know, in the short run, that's good for equity traders. It means you got this big buyer in there pushing up prices kind of indiscriminately. In the long run, it's horrendous because it paralyzes the price discovery mechanism of markets. You know, you and I have talked about this a bunch of times, Kerry. So your listeners probably don't need to hear it again, but it's just a disaster for the concept of capitalism as a wealth creating machine, you know. And what markets do is, when they're actually working, is they allocate capital efficiently from people who have it to people who want to put it to work to create jobs and create wealth in general. But that only works if the price signals that markets generate from free people pursuing their own interests mean something. And if you've got governments in there distorting markets for public policy reasons, then those markets don't work anymore. See, that just goes back to the misunderstanding about how an economy works on the part of the political class and the Keynesian economists who advise the political class. They look at the private sector as this ATM machine where you go to get cash in order to pursue the really important stuff, which is what government is doing, you know, and they don't understand how that wealth is created. They don't understand how the money gets put into the ATM machine to begin with. And it gets in there by markets efficiently allocating capital and creating wealth. Well, if you distort that process, then the wealth creation process grinds to a halt. The ATM doesn't get filled up with cash, and you don't get to withdraw that cash to do stuff with it. You know, it's like Margaret Thatcher's old saying that socialism always breaks down because it eventually runs out of other people's money. Really? And that's what's happening in this world today. Or, you know, go back to Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, which you can criticize on a lot of levels, but its basic message is profound, which is that when government gets too big and too powerful and starts distorting markets, capital goes on strike.
Yeah.
And the creative class basically just leaves the game and says, you know what, if you're going to make it impossible for me to create wealth, I'm not going to bother. You know, I'll just take what I've got and I'll go enjoy my life. I'll sleep in, I'll, you know, ride around on my yacht with fun people.
And hang out with Elon Musk. I mean, look, and the important thing to realize is that this isn't theoretical, right? It's not a theory. It really works this way. People say, well, that's the way it used to work, you know, in the age of the robber barons, but now we're in a different era. But these are economic laws that you really defy at your own peril.
Because oh, absolutely. You know, that's not to say there should never be any regulation. You know, I actually am a big fan of antitrust regulation. I think you should limit the size that entities can expand into because they become market distorters themselves once they get too big. You know, that we have like six banks controlling most of the housing market in the U.S. and most of the rest of the financial markets in the world means that we don't have free markets anymore. And so breaking up the big banks by reimposing Glass-Steagall would actually be a very good thing. That would not be an example of governments distorting markets. That would be an example of governments preserving competition within free markets. Mm-hmm. And so stuff like that is okay. But when you have governments buying bonds across the board to distort interest rate price signaling or you know, next year's story of buying equities across the board, you know, just buying the S&P 500 without regard to, you know, which component of that index is a good buy and which isn't a good buy, pushing the price of everything up, then that's a bad thing. And that's really what we're seeing now. You know, the governments of the world have distorted markets to the point where they don't really even exist anymore. Like the old saying, there are no markets anymore. There are only manipulations. That's very true in a lot of cases.
Chris Powell said so.
Yes, Chris Powell.
Very true. Very true. And very sad, but this is where we're living. This is the world we're living in. And markets are really important, functional, that they function properly and that they properly allocate resources. I mean, it's all economic theory and all that, and risk. You know, markets no longer allocate risk because the prices that things go for are dependent upon the Fed's manipulation of interest rates rather than the actual underlying risk involved in the so-called investment, right?
You know, if you're a hedge fund manager or something like that, by the way, hedge funds are cratering out there all over the place.
Good.
And that's
for them.
One of the reasons that they are, that they evolved to exploit inefficiencies in markets. But if markets are being already manipulated by governments, all the old models that hedge funds used to use to generate alpha, you know, excess return over the risk-free return, you know, they don't work anymore. So these guys who have been superstar investors for 20 or 30 years are basically getting out of the business because the markets don't work anymore and their old models, the things that used to make them money, have failed. And that's an important sign that that we're headed for something really serious here, because if we can't create huge amounts of new wealth via market mechanisms, then we can't service our debts, because we've taken on, you know, the amounts of debt that can only be serviced by a really rip-roaring, growing economy that is creating huge amounts of new wealth to service the debts that we've taken on in the past. And if we can't do that, then that debt is going to crush us. Mm-hmm. So we're heading for a point, Kerry. And, you know, again, as we've talked about a whole bunch of times and your listeners have heard over and over, we're heading for a point where the system just breaks down because mm-hmm. the debts are overwhelming our ability to create new wealth. And, you know, the numbers make it seem like that day is imminent, but who knows?
Hey, you know, don't forget, you know, one thing we didn't mention. Yesterday, Moody's cut Illinois' credit rating to just barely above junk. It's the lowest credit rating that any state in the U.S. has ever had, I guess, since there really wasn't Moody's during the Depression. I don't think they rated government debt back then. But Illinois, I mean, that is the poster child. Puerto Rico's already more or less bankrupt, and there's more to follow here. So something has to give, and I don't think that the feds are just going to print money up and bring these states back to even or less underwater than they are, there's got to be fundamental reform in our financial system, which means in the public pension sector. It's got to happen, because what is the alternative here, John?
Well, the alternative is a gigantic crisis, Gary. And Illinois is probably the catalyst for that part of the process. You know, there are a million things that could blow up and tip the system over into a crisis. And state and city pension plans are definitely on that list. And Illinois is definitely the first of the major ones to go. You know, they're already functionally bankrupt. They haven't had an actual budget for years, and they're borrowing to fund their pension plans, but they're still underfunding the pension plans. You know, the whole pension bond idea is just shocking. Basically, what really badly run states do now is they borrow money and they use it to fund their pension plan on the assumption that the pension plan will generate more return, a higher return with that money than the state has to pay to borrow. Okay.
Arbitrage. And it's an arbitrage.
It is. It's an arbitrage that will blow up in their face, because in a market downturn, the pension fund will generate a negative return. They will actually lose money on their stocks and bonds, while the state will still have to pay that interest rate on the money that it borrowed. Right. So that widens their liability gap, you know, between what they have and what they should have, rather than narrowing it, and brings them that much closer to blowing up. And having their bonds be downgraded by Moody's and S&P and Fitch means that the interest rate that they have to pay goes up, which makes it that much harder for their pension plan to exceed the interest rate on the stuff that they're borrowing. So it brings them closer and closer to just a flat out default, at which point the federal government will have to step in. You know, this will be like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac blowing up in 2008, correct, times five or six. You know, the underfunded pension plans around the country are immense. And if Illinois goes, then New York and Kentucky and New Jersey and California will follow.
And Connecticut, which, don't forget Connecticut.
Connecticut might be right up there with Illinois, apparently, which makes no sense, since Connecticut is home to all the hedge funds, you know, where they should run a budget surplus year after year after year in good times and have a rainy day fund that dwarfs the budgets of most states, but apparently not. You know, well, apparently they're so badly run that they're going to blow up too.
Interesting that you should mention that, John, because there was just an article by the, I think it was the guy who runs Connecticut, their chief fiscal officer, but basically the 50 people who paid the most taxes in the great state of Connecticut basically aren't making as much money as they did 10 years ago, which gives lie to the whole meme that the top 1% are doing better than the great unwashed masses or the remaining 99%. It tells me that, they've made money and they've made back a lot of their losses, but still the struggling economy, you know, they say a rising tide lifts all boats. Well, a declining tide lowers all boats.
Yeah. And if one of these big states goes, we'll see the tide go out for everybody.
Yeah.
Because once one state blows up, say Illinois is forced to default or declare bankruptcy, or, you know, do something that bankrupt shines a light on how bad their finances are, then we start looking around for who's next.
Right. States can't go bankrupt under federal law. There is no means for them to do it. But all of their authorities and all their subdivisions under them can. So I would say that there's going to be some kind of, if it's not a legislative solution to states declaring bankruptcy, it will be a judicial created way of doing it. You know, the legislature in Illinois, they just don't, I mean, the judicial system there, the judges, the Supreme Court, they don't care about anything, because they tried to reform their pension plan just a little bit and it was struck down by the Illinois Supreme Court. You can't screw around with pension plans. They are sacrosanct. And this is madness, because, it's just a total refusal to, face reality by the courts. Say, no, we'll just tax them. Tax them till they die, and we'll worry about it later.
Well, see, that's a symptom of late-stage decadent capitalism with fiat currency, where you haven't had to say no to anybody for decades because you've got this currency that you can just create out of thin air and just hand to people.
That's great.
And so the entire political class from the beginning, you know, from the courts all the way through the legislatures and the executive branches around the country, none of these guys have ever had to prioritize. Mm-hmm. So they have no idea how to look at a situation and say, all right, listen, we need to cut this thing.
Yeah.
And then we need to cut that over there. And then we need to take more from here. You know, they don't do anything like that. They just spread the wealth around by creating new currency and handing it to people. So these guys are temperamentally and intellectually unequipped.
And dishonest.
Dishonesty is kind of a given for these
but
guys.
Intellectually but, dishonest. Intellectual yeah. dishonesty, right? I mean, yeah. let's
Well,
face it.
I mean, they've been honest in terms of the situation within they've been operating,
mm-hmm.
you know, because they've had all this money that they could hand out to people and they could get away with what they were doing. So to them, it was operating honestly because the system's rules were set up in such a way that they were sort of supposed to do what they did. But, you know, now the system is blowing up and they have no idea what to do because they've never had to just sit down with a major constituent and say, now you can't have that. You know, we got to cut your pensions. We've got to dramatically raise your taxes. You know, they've never had to do anything like that. So they're just stumped. They have no idea. And so what has to happen is a crisis has to take place, which flushes out the old political class and ushers in a new political class that's willing to take on these issues. But usually, you know, the crisis has to be pretty immense for something like that to happen. You know, for us to do away with fiat currency, which is really the root of our current problem, you know, to go back to some kind of a gold standard, can you imagine what the list of alternatives would have to be for the world's governments to actually choose giving up their printing presses as the least evil thing that's going to happen to them? You know, they would have to be staring at a Weimar style hyperinflation or a 1930s style capital D depression before going back to a non-fiat currency would seem like the best alternative. So we got to have a gigantic crisis before all this stuff is resolved. And the question then becomes, you know, what's the catalyst? What blows up first? and it could well be state and local pensions. It could also be a lot of other things, you know, normalizing interest rates, Kerry. I'm working on a magazine article now about, you know, what happens if interest rates go back to historically normal levels and the numbers are breathtakingly bad, you know? Japan ceases to exist as a sovereign country if that happens. Europe is just like it's blowtorched, you know, that Europe can't function with normal interest rates. And the U.S., of course, you know, we'd be adding $1 trillion a year to government spending if we let interest rates go back up to 6 or 7 or 8% where they used to be.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So that could happen, too.
We've said this for years. They can't raise rates back to 5%. It's just it's an existential event, the amount of interest that would have to be paid. But hey, we owe the money to ourselves, right? Most of it's internal deficit, so we don't have to worry. We just won't pay ourselves back. We'll just forgive ourselves.
Isn't that an astounding analysis? You know, and you hear that from economists. Oh, it's no problem if you owe the money to yourself. You know, if the currency, if your debt is in your own currency, then you can cover it forever by printing new money, you know, and that leaves out the possibility that nobody will want that currency anymore if you're just going to create unlimited amounts of it.
Well,
to
that
cover
would never happen. That would never happen.
Never happen. You know, the fact that it's happened 1,000 times in previous human history should mean nothing. Don't just ignore history, you know, ignore the Roman Empire and Weimar Germany and post-revolution France. Those aren't good examples because they happened a long time ago and the world is different today. But, the fact is financial laws, as you said, are actual laws. You know, they can be bent, but they don't break because they relate to human decision making and human nature, and those things don't change. So if the supply of a currency starts to expand at a rate that spooks markets, then that currency collapses. And that's what you get if you try to keep interest rates artificially low for an extended period of time. So our choices are let interest rates rise and then collapse, or keep interest rates low and then collapse. And it's really just a matter of timing. I think the keep interest rates low strategy buys us a few extra years, and that's why it will always be chosen by politicians.
Yeah.
But it doesn't solve any actual problem. It just delays the collapse for a little while.
Yeah, just kick the can down the road. That'll do it. Hell, hey. Maybe solar energy will save us, John.
Yeah. You know, solar energy saves the environment, but it doesn't save our finances. Mm. We will transition to clean energy faster than anybody expects. But we will have a gigantic financial crisis along the way, you know? And so I think you could argue that that's better than the opposite. You know, it's better than keeping our finances going for a long time, but having a gigantic environmental crisis. So, you know, I think solar is on balance, a really positive story, and electric cars and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, as you and I were talking about before we went live, it's happening faster than anybody expected. Even the experts 5 years ago did not expect solar and electric cars to be coming along at the speed at which they're coming. So we have gone exponential, and exponential markets are absolutely fascinating and always surprising, because the human brain doesn't process information and extrapolate trends exponentially very easily. You know, we tend to think linearly, where, okay, 5% growth for as far as the eye can see, that's cool, but it'll take 50 years to get to this point. But with an exponential market, that 50-year event horizon collapses down to 5 or 10 years. And I think that's what we're seeing with solar, where it's now so cheap, and the new solar products like Tesla's solar roof are so attractive that it's like air rushing into a vacuum. You know, all of a sudden, boom, everybody's doing it. And the numbers are just get amazing, you know, where... one day in March, for instance, in California, that state got almost half its electricity from solar for a couple of hours, which may not sound like much, except when you consider that solar was less than 1% of the global electricity market a few years before that. And it's still not much more than 1%.
Right.
So for a major state like California to for any period of time to get almost half its power from solar is astounding. And it gives you a little glimpse of the future. You know, if it was 3 hours on that day in March, it's going to be most of the time for 2 weeks in 2018 and half the year in 2020 and so on, you know, until it just takes over. And coal is non-existent as a power source, and oil is an afterthought. That's our world 10 or 15 years hence.
Well, look, you know, coal, definitely there's still a lot of demand for it. A lot of power plants still run on it, but these power plants are old. Generally, they're not building new coal-fired plants as a rule. So those will be replaced. But what's really hit coal the hardest is the declining price of nat gas. That's really knocked coal, because it's cost effective, much cheaper to run a natural gas fired power plant than it is to do a coal fired power plant.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because a natural gas plant is flexible. You can turn it on and off the way you turn your stove on and off.
Yeah.
Whereas a coal fired plant kind of needs to run continuously. So if solar is going to become the baseline power, you know, the thing that runs most of the day, and gives you electricity, and then gas can kick in when there isn't enough solar power coming in, or, you know, you've depleted the batteries that you use with your solar plant or whatever, which frankly is not going to be very much going forward, then you have a system where you've got mostly solar and wind augmented with battery storage, and then gas picking up the little bits of slack, and coal doesn't have a role in that market. So yeah, you know, I think it's almost over. I mean, yes, there will be demand for coal as the current plants run through their useful lifetimes. But if we don't build any more coal plants and we close down the old ones year after year after year, 10 or 15 or 20 years from now, there just won't be very many coal plants operating anymore, and there won't be much point to them. So at that point, it's going to be easy for governments to regulate them out of existence by increasing the or lowering the amount of pollution that they're allowed to produce, increasing regulations on them. So that will accelerate the demise of fossil fuels in general, but coal in particular. Yeah, coal goes first, and then oil goes as electric cars become easier to make and cheaper and because of that, more popular. You know, they're already way more fun to drive. I drove a Nissan Leaf a while ago, which is kind of a low-end electric car. That's not nearly as much fun as a Tesla, but it was a blast. You know, my wife and I were in there. By the time we got out, my wife was lobbying for us just to buy one because she loved driving it so much. So I think if, you know, if that's the case with a low-end electric car, then it's going to be a no-brainer for most people 5 years from now when better, more fun electric cars are out there at the same price, you know, as their prices go down. And with economies of scale and improving battery tech, that's also a kind of a given. You know, electric cars will get cheaper going forward. And since they're already more fun to drive, I think that's going to be another exponentially changing market. And the only thing will be the fact that that there's a huge base of existing cars out there that aren't going to go away, you know? So we'll still have internal combustion engine driven cars for another 20 years as the cars that are being bought today run through their useful lifetimes. But again, you know, it's going to be like digital cameras or something like that, where film dominates the market 1 year and then 10 years later, it's almost gone. You know, and that's how fast, well, that's almost how fast it will happen as the price of electric cars go down. So, yeah, it's going to be a fascinating process. I think, Kerry, it was you who sent me a study, right? That somebody did a study that said 10 years from now, there will be no internal combustion engine driven cars being sold.
Yeah, that was ridiculous.
That's pretty aggressive.
Yeah, because there's certain things that like for hauling trucks, hauling large loads, electric is just not going to do it. Not in its present form.
Right.
You just can't.
But we don't, we don't need to get to that point for there to be a revolution. You know, if it's just 40% of the cars on the road are electric, something like that, which that's an astounding change. And something like that could happen in the next 15 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know about 40%, but it's going to happen. I think politically it's wanted. And I think it just makes certain sense. And then it's going to be interesting. So, hey, we didn't mention today gold is up 1240 the ounce to around 1278 and change. Silver's up 26 to 1753. Probably, you know, if you were listening to the news, they'd say it's because of the lousy jobs report. But this is what's been happening for a while. I guess we're not going to really get any movement in metals till gold breaks 1300 again. But we're getting to a good seasonal spot. You know, summertime, Indian wedding season, got to pay out those dowries if you want to get rid of your daughters, right? So that's kind of what's happening there.
Yeah, gold and silver will take off, and you'll have to be there when it does, because otherwise it'll be like what happened with Bitcoin just lately here, where, you know, one day it's 900 and the next day it's 1700 and the week after that it's 2700.
It's absurd, but
yeah,
Bitcoin is a parabolic market, and I believe in the long run, Bitcoin is going to go a lot higher, but it's going to crash out here, just like it did last time. It's going to crash and burn. I don't care who's buying it, how many Chinese want it, et cetera, et cetera. It's parabolic, and you can't sustain a parabolic rise.
Well,
and it's a market, right? Bitcoin a market.
Well, we need to devote a whole show to this sometime, because I think what's happening now is fascinating in the cryptocurrency space, because Bitcoin is soaring in part because its supply is limited by the algorithm that determines how you create it.
Right.
But the supply of cryptocurrencies in general is not limited. There's very low barriers to entry to that market, which means you need to view Bitcoin in the context of the cryptocurrency space. In other words, what's the total supply of cryptocurrencies?
Yeah, infinite.
And it's infinite, which means the cryptocurrency concept could ignite a hyperinflation, right? If everybody's bringing new coins to market, then and they're being accepted by users, then the supply of that kind of currency goes up exponentially. It's an interesting idea.
It's like mining stocks. It used to be it was difficult to create a new publicly traded mining company, but the wizards of Vancouver can create a mining company. You snap your fingers and they could have one. And it used to be difficult to create cryptocurrencies. And now any idiot with a computer and you know, is able to program in C++ can create a cryptocurrency, right? Anyone can do it.
You know, Bitcoin is not even 50% of the cryptocurrency market
anymore. Third. It's a third.
And that means there are other currencies that are worth more in the aggregate than Bitcoin.
All right.
And
well, here, like just to mention this, we're having a get-together on Monday night talking about mining stocks, precious metals, storage, and Bitcoin. Just go over to Financial Survival Network and sign up for it. You'll see the listing there. And it's going to be interesting. We'll have Andy Schechtman from Miles Franklin. We're having the CEO of SSRI, Silver Standard, which they have some news, and myself, as well as Campbell McCrary. And it's really going to be a great event. It's free. It's going to be June 5th at 7 p.m. So just go over to Financial Survival Network, click the sign up sheet there. You'll see it right on top of this site. And John, we're going to do one also. We'll have a mining company on. We'll talk about cryptocurrencies. We'll talk about storage. And I think it's going to be a great event. So figure next month we'll do one.
Cool.
All right. So
yeah,
we got to go on that note. We're running over. And I got Mickey Fulp coming up with the monthly review. Anyways, find John's excellent work, prolific work over at dollarcollapse.com. And email us, kl@carrylutz.com. Go over to Financial Survival Network. Sign up for that webinar roundtable and sign up for a newsletter. I got one coming out today. So if you miss it, you miss it. And Twitter feed's @CarrieLutz. You can tweet us there. And the Facebook page is Financial Survival Network. Hey, John, thanks for fitting us in this late in the week. And we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carrie. Talk to you then.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.